We got to know where to wait.
Okay, yes.
It would have been just nice to be.
7:47.
Okay.
Call the House Committee on Healthcare to order and open up a work session on Senate Bill 1047. Senator Harker, do you have a motion for me?
I do, Chair Greenlink. I move Senate Bill 1047 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Harker moves Senate Bill 1047 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Will you call the roll, please?
Representative Bruin?
Aye.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative Coyle?
Aye.
Representative Kinnamer?
Excused.
Representative Kotek?
Aye.
Representative Nathanson?
Excused.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Harker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Maurer?
Aye.
Chair Greenlink?
Aye. Motion carries?
Carrier.
Carrier, who wants to carry?
I think you can say that.
Volunteer?
This was.
Oh, I'll carry.
I can do it if you want.
This was the one with the out of state.
Right. No problem.
Okay.
Insurance lover.
But somebody has to explain it to me first.
Yeah.
I close the work session on Senate Bill 1047 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1003. Representative Harker?
I happen to have a motion here, Chair Greenlink. I would move Senate Bill 1003 without recommendation to the Committee on Rules.
Left of the floor.
The recommendation is just.
It can go that way?
But okay. I just took this out of our book.
Okay. We have a motion on the floor. The Speaker has assigned this as a subsequent referral. So we are moving this to rules. Godspeed if we have the votes. Can we have the roll call, please?
Representative Bruin?
Aye.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative Coyle?
Aye.
Representative Kinnamer?
Excused.
Representative Kotek?
Aye.
Representative Nathanson?
Excused.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Harker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Maurer?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Did we forget to have discussion?
Oh.
But I will vote aye.
I'd be happy. Well, we're not done with the votes.
I said I vote aye.
Okay.
Thank you.
We did forget that.
Formalities.
A novice chair, you know, you just have a problem with that.
I think it's the vice chair's job to jab him when that doesn't happen.
Chair Greenlink?
Aye. It is.
It is.
Motion carries and Senate bill.
I just have a question. So this bill will move over to rules as written without the amendment.
Without the amendment, without a recommendation, with the high promise that it will actually come out of rules.
Without the amendment.
That it's not going there to kill it.
Okay.
Without the amendment. Fine. I don't know about amendments. That'll be up to them again.
Of course.
But it does not go with the amendment. Motion carries. Senate Bill
1003
goes to Rules Committee. Close work session on Senate Bill 1003. Thank you all. We worked on those bills long enough. And I think that they'll both go all right.
That's it.
Can I open an informational meeting on the Health Insurance in Oregon report?
There you go.
And invite Ms. Miller to join us, please.
Actually, I want
and walk
to
us through
as
it.
Much of this part as I can. And then Megan is running. Megan is going to come with me.
Action that would take anything mm-hmm. she shows up, mm-hmm. and they want to suspend the rules to let her vote.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Teresa Miller, and I'm the administrator of the Insurance Division at the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I really appreciate the opportunity to be here today to talk to you a little bit about our Health Insurance in Oregon report. As some of you may know, this is actually the fourth report that our department has produced, and it really tries to describe the commercial health insurance market in Oregon, which is the market that DCBS regulates. Talks a little bit about the current rules governing the market, as well as the financial performance of some of our major carriers in Oregon. So because it's such a large document, I did put together a PowerPoint that just kind of highlights some of the big pieces, but I'm also more than happy to answer questions as we go and So you're ready to get started?
Please.
Okay. Let's see if I can figure this out. There we go. So one of the things that this report does is just kind of highlight in a very broad scope how Oregonians and where Oregonians get their health insurance coverage. And as I mentioned, the report really focuses on the commercial state-regulated health insurance market. And so, and I think, Mr. Chair, as we've talked about proposals for mandates in the past, I know one of the things you've often pointed out is we're really talking about impacting about 40% of Oregonians because those are the Oregonians who get their insurance through commercial state-regulated health insurance. So that's that slide. And then this is just the breakdown of how the commercial state-regulated health insurance market breaks down. And my next slide talks about this a little bit, but I would just point out, if you look at the top three, individual, portability, and small group, those total somewhere around 13% of Oregonians. And when we talk about the state's health insurance rate regulation, those are the individuals who are impacted by our rate regulation. We don't have rate regulation in the large group market and associations and trusts, we don't have rate regulation. So we're really talking about that 13% where we have the rate regulation, which gets a lot of focus. And again, these are kind of the points that I've already made. 38% of Oregonians receive their coverage through state-regulated commercial health insurance and 13% through the individual small employer and portability insurance markets.
Please, if we will, please just interrupt and ask questions your own without asking me, and we'll facilitate the exchange that way.
Am I going at an okay pace?
Yeah, this is great. I really appreciate Teresa pointing out the fact that our rate regulation applies just to 13% of Oregonians. How do rates in that band compare generally with rates for those who are insured outside of that narrow band that we regulate? Because there's so much attention paid on that, so much attention paid to the increases. Can we generalize from the experience of that population to what folks in the non-regulated market are experiencing?
It's a good question, Mr. Chair, Representative Cannon. Unfortunately, because we don't regulate the rates in the large group market, I don't know how they compare. I don't see those rates. So I don't know if we can generalize.
Okay.
Sorry.
The big chunk in the large group market now are self-insured anyhow.
Right, which we don't regulate at all. Right.
And I guess that maybe this is a naive question, but even generally, I know that they're very different creatures, this regulated market and the self-insured market. Is one significantly cheaper, better value? I mean, can we even make any kind of characterization there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cannon, in terms of the rates, I really don't know. I don't see those at all, so I hate to comment on something that I know absolutely nothing about.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions before we move
on? How come you don't at least have that as information?
The information in terms of what large groups are paying?
Yeah.
We don't gather that information. So nobody tells us in terms of large group. The regulation that we do have in the large group is we regulate the forms. And we look at the forms. We make sure the mandates are included in the forms. But we don't look at the rates at all. We don't have that authority, and we don't get that information.
Maybe state the obvious, which is we base a lot of conclusions about healthcare on what we know, and what we know, it would appear, a large part of what we know is this very small slice overall of the total market. Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
Well, we've authorized the movement towards a all-payer, all-claims database, which should begin to give us some information. I mean, that was one of the arguments for that, is that we don't know what goes on in most of the environment, and that maybe will help us when we move there.
Right. Ready to move on to financial regulation? And we'll come back to rates, but financial regulation, our Health Insurance in Oregon report does talk a little bit about this. The purpose of financial regulation really is to ensure that insurers possess and maintain the financial resources necessary to pay policyholder claims. And I've said before and will continue to say that I believe this is actually the most important protection we provide in terms of looking out for consumers if their companies aren't around at the end of the day to pay the claims, nothing else really matters.
Is this everybody or only the...
Financial regulation is much broader, yes. So this is insurers who do business in Oregon.
So you get reports from everybody, but you don't talk about rates in those reports?
We get several different kinds of reports. We do, in our financial regulation area, we get financial reports that are separate from some of the other reports that we get. So, and that, I don't believe those have rate information in them. They have premium information in them. They talk about enrollees, the financial condition of the company.
Premium meaning?
In terms of how much premium the company's brought in different segments in different markets. So just all the kind of financial information about the company.
So you could tell us how premiums have increased over time?
We could tell you information about how much in terms of premiums carriers have brought in. But in terms of how much it's costing an individual employer, I don't believe we get that information.
But you have the number of insured and you have the amount of money in premiums collected by those companies?
I believe we do.
So you could produce a measure of how premium per member has increased over large insurers from the data you already have. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, I could go back and see if that's possible for us to create. That's not something that we've looked at in the past, but I could check and see if that's something that we can get.
Or if you could just give us a report on the premiums by company and the people in those companies, we could divide ourselves. Premiums into people.
I just don't know if you can break those. I don't know if you can break that information down so it would actually give you that level of information. But I can go back and check.
Thank you.
This next slide I included just because I think oftentimes our financial regulation and the importance of our regulation, it gets overlooked and it's easy to... It's not very sexy. It's not like rate regulation. People aren't really interested in it. But again, I do think it provides a lot of protection for consumers. And an example, just very recently, in 2009, we had a very small regional carrier called Preferred Health Plan in Klamath Falls who simply was not generating enough premium to pay their expenses. And the insurer's capital and surplus fell below the required minimums. We actually have statutory minimums. They fell below the statutory minimums. And the department, essentially, we ordered the company to increase their capital and surplus to meet those minimums, and the company was just unable to do that. So we ended up working very closely with the company to assist them in withdrawing from the market. And after a year later, we are almost completed with that process. And this next slide just talks a little bit about we were very involved in the process of assisting policyholders because this company had somewhere around, I think, at one point 3,500 policyholders. And so we were very involved and worked very closely with the company in assisting the policyholders to ensure that they weren't stuck at the end of the day when their company went out of business, essentially, and made sure that they all got moved to another carrier. We also worked with them to make sure, for example, in the individual market where you have underwriting, the concern was if we have individuals who have been underwritten, they got individual coverage through PHP, but if they now have to go apply for individual coverage from another carrier, they could get denied. So we worked with other carriers to make sure that if an individual had coverage, they could essentially waive the underwriting and maintain their coverage with another carrier. And so we were able to make all those transitions, and I feel very good that we were able to protect all the policyholders in that situation. Rate regulation, the part that people are very interested in. So, and we've talked a little bit about this, so I don't want to belabor this, but I know this is the area that people are very interested in. When we review rate filings, we're really looking primarily at two questions. And Mr. Chair, I think you have also highlighted for us in the past the second question. The first question is the aggregate or the average rate request justified? That's the easy one. That's the one that everybody looks at and everybody cares about, I guess. But the second question is the one that can be overlooked, and it's the question of how does the aggregate rate request, how does it translate into individual increases for various groups? and is it allocated fairly among the groups? And we have seen rate requests that you could have, for example, a 6% aggregate rate request, which sounds very reasonable, doesn't sound problematic, but that aggregate rate request could actually mean that some individuals are getting, or some groups are getting, a 50% increase, for example. Others may be getting a decrease. So there's a wide variety in terms of the impact. Sometimes, not in all cases, but sometimes that's true. That is one of the things we look at when we're reviewing rates. And oftentimes, if we have that wide disparity, we will work with the company to see if they can mitigate that impact on those people who are scheduled to get very high increases. These are some of the key factors that DCBS currently uses and will continue to use in terms of determining whether or not the overall rate request is actuarially justified. The first thing we look at is historical and projected loss ratios. And this is essentially the percent of premium spent to pay medical claims. We also look at historical and projected trend, which is the increase in claims costs for year over year. And that essentially has two components. One is the increase in medical inflation, the increase in costs, and increase in use or utilization. We also look at historical and projected administrative costs, which we've also talked about in this committee, and I'll talk a little bit more on the next slide, and net income target, or essentially the projected profit or loss. And you all are familiar with this, so I won't spend too much time on it, but House Bill 2009 made some significant changes to our rate regulation process that I think really strengthens our process. There's really three major changes that bill made to our process. One, it requires insurers to separately report and justify administrative expenses. And I'll talk a little bit later about why that's important, but one of the issues just to think about is when we look later at the administrative expenses of companies and we compare those numbers, today we're not necessarily comparing apples to apples because insurers don't report everything the same in terms of administrative expenses. So that's where I think that one becomes important. The second change is DCBS will now have explicit authority to consider an insurer's overall finances, looking at things like profits and investment income and surplus when reviewing a proposed rate. And finally, consumers now have an opportunity to comment on all individual small employer and portability rate filings. All these things are effective as of April 1 of this year. We have implemented some of these already, like the public comment period, and the public is now already commenting on rate requests. And the last thing I'll say, some of you probably saw the news this week. We just adopted rules implementing, actually, House Bill 2009. That really increased the transparency, I think, of our process. And I think given the changes that you all made to our process with this bill, as I talk to other states, I represent Oregon at our National Association of Insurance Commissioners at our meetings where we meet with all the other states. And what's striking to me is the work that we've done here in Oregon really is unique. And I want you all to know that because as I talk to other states, I think in terms of the strength of our process and the strength of our standards, we are absolutely on the forefront of what states are doing. And I think a lot of other states are going to start looking to us in terms of the transparency around our process. Particularly as we start having conversations around health reform. I think the more transparency we have around this process, the better. Okay. And actually, I'm going to skip this slide because we have other slides that are going to cover that information.
We're going to talk a little more about administrative costs.
We will talk more about administrative costs. Health insurance premiums. So this has been a topic, obviously, of much discussion of late. So these are the average annual increases in the small group market. And you'll notice that since 2005, we've actually seen a decrease in these rate increases. But I think it's also important to note that these increases, especially the last 4 years, really tend to mirror increases in medical claims costs, which I think really just go to a point that I've made many times, which is, the cost of and use of healthcare really are what's driving health insurance rates. And I think it's important to recognize that. I also, and I think I mentioned this in my testimony a few months ago when we were talking about rate increases, there's data from the Commonwealth Fund that indicates as of 2008, Oregon small employer rates are the 25th most expensive in the country. So in other words, we're right in the middle in terms of what small employers are paying for health insurance.
Just for the record at this point, we note that in absolute terms, the costs have gone up about, well, something over 60% over that time period. These are compounded rates. So
right.
If you take 2004 to 2009,
good point.
They're about 60% more in absolute dollars. And that becomes relevant when we start talking about administrative costs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which is why we're going to look at them separately. Exactly. Health insurance premiums in the individual market. You'll note that this market clearly has had more volatility than, for example, the small group market that we just looked at. And, you know, I want to talk just briefly. One of the reasons that we had this sharp increase in rates from 2007 to 2008 was really the result of some actions that took place a few years before that. I think I've mentioned to this committee before, in 2006, following a profitable period, Regents, which was our largest carrier in the individual market, lowered its rates by 16% in the market. And because they're the largest carrier, that really encouraged or forced, I suppose you could say, other carriers to suppress their rates in this market. And so at some point, given the fact that increases in medical costs continued to happen, the rates just were not able to sustain the costs. And so we did see significant increases between 2007 and 2008. And I do expect that those will level off going forward. Market share. This is another point that I think I've made a couple different times, but again, as I talk to other states, I think it's a point worth noting. When you look at a lot of other states, a lot of these markets really are dominated by one or two major carriers. And in at least 21 states, one carrier controls more than half the market. Oregon really is different because we have seven health insurers that split the market. And between the seven, they earn 91% of the premiums. But I was looking at a chart the other day that had all the various states, and Oregan really does stick out just
this
because we have...
Is individual market we're talking about here, or all?
This is all. This is just health insurance. Right.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
I know. Teresa, can we compare that to any of the other states? I mean, we've always been in a good position with multiple insurance carriers, the seven. But when we look at the information we know about the rate increases compared to other states that have only one or two major, how do we compare in general terms? Because we still see pretty exasperating rate increases. What are other states seeing that only have one or two competitors?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin, I haven't looked at it with that fine tooth, but when we look at just what other states are seeing, and again, we are unique and a lot of states have this, we're looking at the same types of increases. What's amazing to me is states across the country are looking at double-digit increases in both the small group and individual markets. So, I mean, not all of them, not across the board, but we are certainly not unique. There are a lot of other states in the same position.
Okay.
So,
interesting. Thank you.
Yeah.
It's counterintuitive.
Mm-hmm. It is. It is. I just use this slide again as just an example of how Oregon sticks out when you look at some of the other states. And in Alabama, their top two insurers are 88% of the market, Hawaii 98% of the market, Montana 85%, and Oregon is 56%.
Teresa, that says the premiums were $5 billion. Your table figure 415 says it's more like it's under $3 billion. What's the difference between those numbers?
Which table are you looking at?
I just picked one out at random. Figure 415, page 40. It has the premiums. Right?
That's in the large group market.
Oh, well,
so that's
right.
Just the.
That's only the large group market.
Right. This is a total.
Okay.
Okay.
Got it. Is there a table that has that on it?
It has the total information. Mm-hmm. Yes. Let me find that. I believe that is the table on page 32, all markets.
There it is. But not by company.
Not that table, right?
There's a 2/8. Okay. Thank you.
Uh-huh. So the next slide just shows how the market share breaks down with our various carriers. Regence, obviously, is our largest carrier with 31% of the market. Kaiser is our second largest with 25% of the market. And then you've got Providence at 10%, Pacific Source at 9%, HealthNet at 8%, LifeWise at 5%, and ODS at 3%.
And this, that table doesn't include third-party administrative rates for things like Regence. That's a pure insurance rate. I think I remember about 60% of Regent's businesses, third-party administrator, where they're not at risk for insurance.
And I think, let me just double check.
We should have to give you questions in advance like we do on the floor.
No, it's fun.
This is not fair.
I appreciate that.
Stump the stars.
Premium earned in 2008, and I'm trying to think. Where's this chart? Mr. Chair, I think this is earned premium. I don't think this would include TPA business.
I would think that.
I think this is just small group, large group, association, individual, Medicare, Medicaid's probably. Medicare, Medicaid would be in here, right?
Medicare supplements might be in there. I'm sorry, Teresa. Just move on.
Okay.
I didn't mean to confuse you.
That's all right. It's easy to do. This next slide is basically a chart of profitability over the last 10 years. And I put it in this format just to kind of show the cyclical nature of profit for Oregon health insurers.
Well, it looks like the stock market. Mm-hmm. Which may not be accidental, huh? Mm-hmm.
And I just included this slide just so you can see that we've got 3 of our 7 carriers are for-profit carriers and 4 of our carriers are not-for-profit carriers. And that becomes important when we talk about this next slide, surplus levels. I just wanted to spend a little
bit... I'm sorry. Oh. Can we go back?
Uh-huh.
ODS isn't nonprofit, but is it investor-owned?
ODS is owned by a nonprofit.
But is it owned by a nonprofit?
You know, let's look. We have that information in here, I believe.
I thought it used to be owned by a nonprofit.
It's a subsidiary of the not-for-profit Oregon Dental Service.
No, so it's not investor-owned. It's for profit, but it's different than the others, I think, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Right. So I wanted to talk just briefly about surplus because I find this chart really interesting and I thought it'd be helpful just to give you a little bit of perspective on it. I think, first of all, it's helpful when we look at charts like this to understand why surplus is needed. I think the word surplus can be misleading and it can make you think of things like extra or unnecessary. I think it's more helpful to think of surplus in terms of reserves.
And that's a chart on page 25, is it?
This is the chart on...
Yes, I think it's on page 25.
Yes, page 25. Surplus helps companies maintain financial stability during times of unexpected losses or economic downturns or when costs just rise rapidly. Most states have minimum surplus requirements, and these requirements help ensure that insurers possess and maintain the financial resources that are needed to pay policyholder claims. As a regulator, our primary concern is really to ensure that companies have enough surplus that they're able to pay claims. That's truly our primary concern. And as I mentioned earlier, we recently assisted an insurance company with withdrawing from the market because they just simply didn't have enough surplus. The department uses technical standards established by our national association to ensure insurer solvency and financial stability. And these standards are used throughout the country, and they're known as what we call risk-based capital standards, RBC. And RBC establishes minimum levels of surplus using risk factors that vary company to company, and they're based on things like asset risk, premium volume, and underwriting results. So the one thing I would caution when you're looking at a chart like this is not to look at it in terms of just the dollar figures. The dollar figures in and of themselves don't really tell you very much. You could have a company with twice as much surplus as another company that still has solvency concerns simply because of the various risk characteristics. So that's my caution.
Help us understand this. There's a number, let's take any number. The second number down for Kaiser in 2008 was $480 million. That doesn't mean it produced $480 million that year. It means that...
Right.
That at the end or the middle, at some point in the year,
right.
That's how much was in the bank.
Correct. That's how much surplus they had.
Profitability is going to look very different
yes.
than this.
Absolutely.
Although it's a factor in producing this.
Exactly. That's exactly right. I also just want to point out in terms of the differences between for-profits and not-for-profit companies, if you'll notice that the companies that are at the top of this chart in terms of dollar figures are our not-for-profit companies. And there are reasons why you would want your not-for-profit companies to have more surplus than your for-profit companies. Your for-profit companies will issue dividends to shareholders, which will keep their surplus levels lower. They also have additional access to capital. They often have parent companies that they can go to for that. Where not-for-profit companies don't have that additional access to capital. And they also just essentially are left relying exclusively on their surplus for unexpected expenses, for investment losses, or for investments in the company. So their surplus is much more important in terms of their business. Having said all that, as premiums do continue to increase, we also want to monitor surplus levels to ensure that they don't get too big, which is a much more difficult question to answer than the minimum surplus levels. Beginning in April, as I mentioned earlier, thanks to House Bill 2009, we will have the explicit authority to take into account surplus levels when we're reviewing rate filings. And frankly, as we go forward, we're going to be looking very closely at these levels as we review various rate filings. So.
No, I'm sorry, Nancy. Just please ask questions.
Oh, okay, thank you. Teresa, before we move away from this slide, I wanted to ask if you've ever considered preparing a chart that presents the information in a different manner. And here's why I'm asking. When you mentioned that we shouldn't think necessarily only of the dollars because it doesn't take into consideration other things, the first thing I was looking at is, well, some of these are really big, some are at the bottom,
mm-hmm.
but I was trying to compare it over on another chart to the proportion of market share. So, you know, bigger market share, bigger companies, you would expect to be toward the top of, you know, one of the top lines because it's proportional. So sometimes when you're looking at a chart like this, you think something that's way at the top or way at the bottom, that means relatively they're a lot better or a lot worse, and it's not.
Right.
You know, in some ways, presenting it this way, it doesn't add value to understanding the situation.
Mm-hmm.
So then I thought, well, maybe, I started looking at it quickly as you were talking. So if you look at market share, which ones would I expect to be on the top and second and third? And I found something that for me was a little bit of an anomaly. There's a market share, one company has 10%, one has 9%, but their numbers on the line graph are farther apart than I would have anticipated.
Hmm.
I thought, well, I wonder why that is.
Just ask a question.
So, do you think you could prepare something that would show us, without the other risk factors that you've been pointing out to us, how... something like that, so we could see how they compare to each other, how much surplus they have on hand. It's sort of like when we get data per capita, if
mm-hmm.
you will.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, I can certainly go back. I mean, this is actually an issue that I find really interesting that we've been digging into a little bit more. So I'd be interested in looking at other ways we can present it. So we'll absolutely look at that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Medical loss ratios. Medical loss ratios are the percentage of health insurance premium that an insurer pays out in medical health care claims.
Yeah, an awful way to refer to that. I mean, as
medical
if it's bad,
ratio.
Yeah, if it's
like
bad
it's bad,
to pay a claim.
They're actually paying claims. That's not a bad thing, right?
It's weird.
These are not bad things. And the average for our seven carriers in Oregon is 91%, which I think if you track this sort of thing is seems high to me. I mean, I don't think that's anything to be disappointed in terms of the 91 cents of every premium dollar is going to pay medical claims.
Great.
That seems like a very good thing. And of course, this, excuse me, these numbers are large group, small group, it's all combined. So this is just a total 91.
Can I push back on that a little bit? Mrs. Insurance companies won't like it, but a lot of the administrative burden gets pushed back down to the providers. And it's, in that world, it was incredibly frustrating. And I'm not saying that everybody's trying to save money, but, you know, some of the burden is being pushed back down to providers in order to save money for the plan. And it's through prior authorizations and all the nut roll that has to go through to get that. I mean, I think that is...
And that would be fine as long as the providers were being paid.
Correct. And even further, the specialists push that burden back down to the primary care providers.
I appreciate that.
I know you can't do anything about it.
I'll stay away from that one.
But still, I mean, the argument, one of the things people worry about, and here's what we're going to be talking about, is it's not going to health insurance CEO salaries. It's not going to that.
No, and I think that's one of the arguments in you know, healthcare in Oregon is that, I mean, I refer to it more than a couple of times. You say health insurance in Oregon is competitive.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and there was argument about it. And, in fact, we do a pretty good job, our companies. It's all visible. You know, it's this book, there's, you know, anybody can go get it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's easy to bash the insurance companies, but, you know, Oregon isn't the problem. And that's one of our, you know, it's Texas and it's Florida and all those, Louisiana, that are horrible.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, I think you bring up a good point. I think in the discussion that has taken place around healthcare reform at the national level, I think we may have been a little bit better in Oregon, but at the national level, certainly, there's a lot of misinformation and bad information. And frankly, I think there's just a lot of misinformation out there for consumers in terms of why their health insurance rates continue to go up. And I was talking earlier about increasing the transparency. I mean, you're right. Putting out books like this, and a lot of what we do at the department is really aimed at just getting the information out there for people so they know what's going on. One of the biggest things I think we've done, and it hasn't gotten near the press attention that some of the other things we've done has gotten, but I would argue it's one of the most important things we've done in terms of increasing the transparency of our process for consumers is to do, and I think I handed out a copy of one of our rate decision summaries that we've put together. That's been our attempt for each rate filing to explain to the consumer in plain language what's really happening. And one of the things we've done with the public comments, you know, we've been collecting public comments in our rate filings now for a couple of months, and we get a lot of public comments about executive compensation. That's clearly something that consumers are very concerned about, and yet we know that's obviously not what's driving rates. But one of the things, again, I can't change somebody's perception, but what I can do is give them information to let them know what's really going on. So we've tried to even include information, you'll see it in the summary I gave you, about what percent of your premium per member per month is going to executive compensation, just so that people understand if you're concerned about that, here's what you're concerned about. It's 28 cents a month, essentially, and
Teresa,
maybe that's outrageous.
That's not the issue. Here's the issue. The point I was making before is health insurance rates have gone up roughly 60% over the last 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
A big function of that is the increase in the cost per claim.
Mm-hmm.
that's gone, that represents two-thirds of that increase is the cost per claim. Now, the administrative rates have stayed the same, but I say the same as a percentage, but it shouldn't be any more expensive to pay a $100,000 claim than it is to pay a $90,000 claim. So what's happened is the administrative dollars per person have gone up significantly at the same rate of those claim expenses. And that's what's bothering people.
And Mr. Chair, that's exactly why you passed House Bill 2009, and now we're going to be collecting that data separately. And essentially, insurers are going to have to separately report and then justify increases. And we're going to be able to look over time and see not just total administrative expenses, but we're going to have a breakdown to see really what's happening. And I think, and frankly, from my perspective, I think for administrative expenses, transparency is huge. It's important for consumers to understand what goes into administrative expenses and where that money's going. So that's a lot. And as I mentioned before, if you look at this slide, you'll notice that the administrative expenses do vary fairly significantly even. And as I said before, it's difficult today to compare and look at these numbers and say one company's doing better than the other company because we just don't have the apples-to-apples comparison that we hopefully will have in the future. You look like you have a question.
I do have a question. I was waiting for a point, so thank you for providing one. What can we conclude, if anything, from the fact that the data on this table plus the previous one, in some cases for HealthNet, add up to 100%. There's 91% is in the loss ratio, and the balance of 100% is here under general administrative expenses. In other cases, that's the case for the top two, at least in 09, the 09 data as they were up through September. Mm-hmm. In other cases, all the other cases, they don't add up to 100%. Where is the balance in those categories, and what does it say, if anything, as a difference between HealthNet and Kaiser versus the others?
Do I have, Mr. Chair, Representative Harker? I'm just looking. This is the general administrative expenses, and I believe we've separated out general administrative expenses and claims adjudicative expenses. So the difference could be in that. Let me look at this.
Bill.
Really quickly.
If this is a rat hole in terms of today's discussion, we don't have it.
The question is to have this discussion.
All righty. Well, then I'm right on track here. As are we all.
So, yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Harker, if you look at page 27, that has general administrative expenses. These are administrative expenses that are not directly related to paying claims. If you look at the next page, page 28, I'm in the right book, yes. Page 28 are claims adjustment expenses. And so that's going to be part of the difference in what you're looking at. The other part could be net underwriting gain or loss and... yeah, those would be the other pieces that would make up the 100%.
Okay, thank you. It'll take a little while for me to process how this all fits together, but thank you.
Yes.
Where do profits go?
Net investment.
Where are they? So profitability is...
Where do they go? Dividends paid in the investment-owned companies.
Investment income? Is that what you're looking for?
That word.
Net investment income is on page 30.
Well, no. I'm sorry.
That's the chart of investment income.
All income earned from invested assets.
Minus expenses.
Yeah. Oh, the investment income, that's different. That's income that's earned from
investment.
Money you put in the stock market.
Right.
Reserves.
But I was talking about if one of the differences might be if some of these are investor-owned, they pay a dividend to their investors. Where would that be?
There are no publicly traded companies.
I thought there were two of them that were here.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that's not anything that's going to be in this report, but I think, again, if you look at, and I don't know if that would be reflected in profitability.
No.
I'm
sorry.
But we don't have information on dividends paid in this book.
Can I get back to a point that Representative Greenlick brought up, and that was, in fact, the cost per claim. And over time, as each claim gets more expensive, then the administrative piece of that. If it stays the same, it grows also. And there was a study done by the, actually I've got it here, the Heritage Foundation, which, you know, people can argue, but it was comparing just in general private per claim costs versus Medicare. And in the Medicare side, it had costs per claim in 2005 were $509, and on the private side, $453 cost per claim per rep.
Can you say those numbers again? I'm sorry.
Not is outlays, excuse me, outlays per beneficiary based on administrative costs. So the cost to administer one Medicare patient in 2005 was $509. The cost per patient in the private market, and I'm not sure, and I don't know the rationale, you know, what's considered in and out, was $453.
So I mean, the cost per claim and the cost per
No, I'm sorry, cost per beneficiary over an annual period.
Mm.
And so I think that is important, that in fact you figure out what is the cost per beneficiary or per life over a calendar year or whatever would be consistent.
Oh, but the argument is it isn't any more expensive to pay an expensive claim than an inexpensive claim. It is more expensive to pay 5 claims rather than 2 claims or 20 claims rather than 5 claims.
Correct.
And I mean, seniors have many more claims per person.
You know, when I get a check in our clinic that's 2 cents, somewhere somebody lost money in processing that claim.
Including you.
Including me. But the point is, I think that those apples to apples, like Representative Nathanson was talking about, you know, in the per capita over a period of time is, quite frankly, really helpful information, mm-hmm. if it's possible to get.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay, I'm done.
Okay. And finally, this is a slide that just talks about the financial condition of insurers, just sort of general points. I think what you'll see in this report, and the only bad part about these reports is they're always a year behind, so we're always a little bit delayed. Obviously, things have gotten a little better in 2009, but in 2008, I think what you see reflected in the report is the fact that the economy had an impact on insurance companies in Oregon. And we saw 5 of the 7 largest health insurers lost enrollees. Only 2 of the 7 contributed to surplus, which was unusual. 6 of the 7 largest health insurers earned the majority of their premiums from the large group market. And all except Regent saw a decline in net income after taxes from 2007 to 2008. And 3 of the 7 largest insurers reported net losses after taxes. So that's just kind of a snapshot of some of the financial information.
And all but one added to surplus in the year-to-date 2009.
In 2009, right? This is 2008 data.
All but one added to surplus in the first
in 2009. Months.
First
right.
9 months.
And that's all
it's
I
not
have.
Not in 08, though. I mean, they're dropping in 08. Which
08 was
the
only down year in the last 10 years.
But
right.
Just for apples to apples, so that's conclusions about 08.
Right, right. This is all 08 data.
Teresa, somebody listening or watching this may be wondering why so much of our regulatory attention is paid to the fiscal sort of solvency of the fiscal health of these companies. I'd appreciate hearing you articulate why the most important work of this state agency is in preserving the balance sheets of these companies. And those aren't your words, those are mine, but I have inferred based on other things you've said that that is the case. So could you articulate that?
And Mr. Chair, Representative Cannon, I think really the Klamath Falls example to me is the best example just in terms of the importance of that work. If a company's not bringing in enough money to pay their expenses, they're not going to be around. And if they're not around, they're not going to be able to pay claims, and then we're going to end up with policyholders that are stuck without a company having to look for another company. And so I also don't mean to leave the impression that our rate review responsibilities are not important. I spend much more of my time on our rate review process than I do our financial regulation process. But when something happens like with the Klamath Falls insurer, I end up spending a lot of my time on that just because, again, we had 3,500 policyholders at that point that had to find someplace else to go. And so making sure that they're moving and getting coverage and finding coverage is important. So at the end of the day, and I think the one other thing I would say, and I think I made this point when we were looking at the first draft of House Bill 2009, because it was suggesting that we should separate these roles. I think for the very reason that I talked about in terms of the Klamath Falls situation, it's really important to have the same agency doing both of those things, because oftentimes I'll look at a rate filing and then go talk to our financial folks about it just to make sure that we're not going to do anything on one side that's going to jeopardize the other side. But our rule is...
First draft was going to move both of them.
Was to move everything health insurance related. And I think my point in my presentation was that whatever you do, separating those out, the issue was our financial regulation isn't done by health insurer. It's we do all insurers in our financial regulation. We don't separate out health. That I don't want to leave the impression that the rate review is not important. And it's not important to me that we're making sure companies are making a lot of profit either. My issue is making sure that they're solvent, which is a different issue perhaps than the way you articulate it in terms of balance sheet. I want to make sure they're around, and I want to make sure they're solvent. But it's we have dual roles here, and it's important, I think, to look at both of them. And that's why I mentioned what I did around the surplus. I mean, our primary responsibility is to make sure they have enough surplus, but I am also very concerned about the other side, and I want to make sure that if they're getting to the point where they have too much surplus, I want to address that as well. So
you and Representative Cannon are both too young to remember, but I have in my memory bank a fairly substantial size health insurance company in Oregon that went broke or was about to go broke, owing a lot of claims to a lot of people, because claims go on and they have a tail.
Yeah.
And I think we managed to squeeze out of that one. I think maybe Mike, he's too young too. But it was a really significant problem. I mean, there were millions of dollars left of claims already delivered that there wasn't the money to pay for.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what push to strengthen this whole solvency piece.
And I appreciate the attention to that. Of course, the last thing we want is to leave the consumer sort of holding the bag with a plan that they paid for that isn't good for anything because the company's
or the provider
insolvent. Right, or the provider. But I guess I'd push on this a little. I suppose there is a company, I'm not suggesting that there is, but suppose one of our health insurers is not well run, not well managed, is losing money, is heading that direction. Would it not be appropriate for the market force in that case to, you know, drive that company out of business because, frankly, they're not able to compete well? Or is it the state's role to sort of, and again, we're not talking about spending taxpayer dollars bailing out companies. I recognize that that's not what's at stake here. Nevertheless, your agency is about approving rates that do help save companies, including potentially ones that could not be particularly well managed.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Cannon, I also want to be really clear here. We didn't save this company in Klamath Falls. We protected the policyholders as the company withdrew from the market. So our role was not to bring the company back to life. Our role was to make sure that whatever happened with that company, the policyholders were protected. And so when we see a company that's going into financial hardship or they've got concerns, we have all sorts of different levels of monitoring companies. At the end of the day, it's the management of the company's responsibility to make sure that their company stays solvent. if we have concerns, we will work with that company. We will talk to the management and ask them, okay, if your surplus isn't where it needs to be, what's your plan to get it where it needs to be? If they can't ultimately get it there, our role is to step in and make sure that they do go away if that's what needs to happen to protect policyholders, and that we then do what we did in the Klamath Falls example, where we worked very closely with that company, but we also worked very closely with other companies just to make sure that those, and let me be very clear, I mean, I don't think the company management necessarily understood what our role was, because I think they were expecting us to sort of bail them out. I kept making it clear to them, our responsibility is to protect the policyholders. I am much less concerned about, at that point, about the company as I am about the policyholders. And my job at that point is just to make sure that that transition works for policyholders and they don't get left holding the bag. So I just want to be very clear. It's not about saving the company. It's about protecting the policyholders.
I appreciate you articulating that. Thanks.
Hi. Go ahead. Your comment spurred me back to something Representative Nathanson was talking about, the reserves. In these comparisons of apples to apples is now PEB and OEB. Because PEB is, we are self-insured. Mm-hmm. And I think we have just as much, we have a vested interest that PEB maintains an adequate reserve so that the state isn't having to go and, you know, take some general fund dollars and, you know, which we would do, but that would be a really disastrous situation being. I'm assuming that they do manage that. The figure I heard today was $88 million would be an appropriate reserve. But
that's not enough to me.
Well, there's only 100,000 lives in PEP, only 100,000 lives, and I'm looking at Regents has 209,000 in its large, 88,000 in its individual plan, and something else, 65 or something in its small group.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, just let me be very clear. We don't regulate PEB.
I understand you're PEB, okay. But those figures should be, abundantly clear,
saying, yeah,
so that you can say, well, this is what we're doing. How are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
We're both, you know, to triangulate that, in fact, we are not leaving something
mm-hmm.
off the table.
Kaiser has about 100 million for 100,000 people, roughly.
Okay. Okay. And so, and I don't know what an appropriate reserve is. I don't know.
Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, I've actually spent quite a bit of time reading about all sorts of reports that I found online about surplus and what's adequate and what's too much. And you can read a lot and you get done reading and think, I don't know what I just learned there. You just get into a point where nobody is willing to say at this point. There's too many factors, I think, that come into consideration, and that's why I've actually spent time talking to our national association, talking to other states, talking to anybody I can talk to about surplus, because it is an area that I think is really interesting. And now that we're going to have new authority in our rate review process to look at that, I want to make sure we're doing it prudently, though. And so I, you know, again, we have those two hats, but I think it's an interesting question to start looking at. When does it get to be too much, and how does that factor into our rate review process?
I have a little detail I'd like to follow up on. It's along the lines of solvency and protecting the interests of the policyholders.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say there's an insurer that is going out of business. Different companies have different rules for what might exempt someone from being able to buy insurance. You know, the kinds of conditions that exclude you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't want to cover you if this or if that. What happens to a company that was, let's say, a little more generous, either in all areas or in some areas, and was covering people who had this or, you know, condition A or B or C, and you can't find another company that will cover someone who had a policy. They can't get a policy anymore. Then what do we do?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, I assume you're talking about the individual market where we have underwriting.
Right.
And as I mentioned in the Klamath Falls example, that was actually one of the things that we were very concerned about. They didn't have a lot of people in the individual market. I want to say they might have had 30 people. It was fairly limited. But one of the things we did do, and again, a lot of what we were doing was just looking at the policyholders and trying to protect them. We talked to other companies to find out, would you be willing to not go through the underwriting process again for this person? This person's gone through the underwriting for PHP. They're covered. Will you just take them without underwriting? And we got companies to agree to do that. If, of course, we couldn't get that to happen, we have the high-risk pool and we have OMIP. So that would be an option for those individuals. But I think from our perspective...
A state solution rather than a private sector solution.
But I think we're interested... I mean, in the PHP example, we were able to find a private solution because, again, okay. I think other companies recognized what was going on and some of them wanted to help. And so we do the best we can in terms of that, but there is a state solution as a backup.
But you've obviously got something in place. Thanks.
Do you say reserves and surpluses synonymous? I seem to remember I had some trouble trying to understand the difference between.
And you know what? And Gail, correct me if I'm wrong.
Come on, you can get some help.
I've actually, I brought her just in case you guys ask me some tough questions. our actuaries have corrected me on this. My understanding is reserves, it's not accurate. I think of surplus as reserves, but I don't think it's accurate to say surplus are reserves. I think reserves are there to cover the incurred, the, is it IBNR, incurred but not reported claims. So I don't want to say too much because this is getting outside without an actuary here to back me up. Do I sound like I'm a surplus? They're a component of surplus, though.
Right. The other surplus is money you're holding, or maybe down payments for future buildings or something
right,
like that.
Right, correct.
So is there a table on reserves as well as...
There's not. There's not.
You saved us that question. In past years, there have been both, and it's very confusing.
In the past, there was reserves broken out?
Yeah. I'm glad they're not.
Yeah, I didn't recall that we'd broken those out in the past.
Oh, I have to for you.
Oh, not in our report. You're talking about just...
I'm talking about this report in past years. We've gone over it here. One of the big questions is, what's the relationship between reserves and surpluses? And one of the issues is how much of the surpluses the set-aside reserves for claim payments.
I do appreciate you up here. We get to see the body language behind...
Yeah, we're watching
and
her.
You are, it is
she's
saying,
cringy. No, she's cringy, yeah, isn't she?
So we... No, she's...
She's back there going...
No,
not at all.
She's the ventriloquist. She's hoping your mouth moves as she moves.
Have you finished your presentation?
I have.
Okay.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here. I hope that was helpful.
I would really urge us all to spend a little time with this book and then ask specific questions. And if anybody asks a dumb question like me or somebody else, would you share the answer with all of us? Because...
If I get questions after this,
absolutely. Because we're all going to have, I mean, this is a complicated.
It truly is. What's amazing to me about this report is I've been around for two of these so far, and each time the editing process, I won't even describe to you because it's painful, but I read it I don't know how many times, and what's scary, I guess, is that every time I read it, I learn something new. It's amazing.
Can I ask, do you ask the insurers how this is presented? Do they have any input, say, well, this isn't really what we think it is?
Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, the data in here actually comes from insurers. And in particular, I think the data pieces that are specific to the insurers, we send that out to them ahead of time just to make sure that they don't dispute anything that we're planning to put in there. And sometimes we'll have some back and forth if there's disagreement. But the other thing, go ahead.
Do they have an opportunity to say, yeah, this format works, and or suggest changes, maybe next year you do
Mr.
that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer,
So Becky, you want to comment on that?
One of the things we do, and I would actually put this out to all of you, our goal in putting this report out is to make a report that's as useful as possible. And one of the things I've said to insurers, and I know Michael backed me up, and to consumer groups and to others, and I would say the same thing to you, is if there's something that's missing in here or something that we should put in differently, if there are questions you have that we haven't answered or issues we should explore, you'll notice that in this report we did some things differently. We added some charts. We did a few things differently just to try to address some issues, but I'm open to, frankly, anybody's suggestion about how we can improve it. So if you have any, please let me know.
Mr. Becker, do you want to comment?
Yeah. Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, Mike Becker with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Frankly, I find this report incredibly useful, and I have used it in a variety of settings with audiences and in meetings that run the gamut. And the fact that it is gathered from reported financial and claims data that the department has, it's presented in a very logical, easy-to-read fashion, it just resonates with people. And I've heard others from outside of the state of Oregon, when I show this document, point to it and go, wow, I wish our state had something like that. So it is a very useful document, in my estimation.
And I apologize, I will shut up, but my comment is in the debate about health care and health insurance, it gets very heated. But one thing that's been really helpful in this debate is something that you agree on, everybody's going, yeah, okay. I mean, so you don't start from points that are so far, well, explain that number. If you go back to here, you generally get, okay. So that your debate is not about what number you invented, but about maybe the policy issue around that number. So that's been extremely helpful. And you can tell me I'm wrong. But.
And sometimes debate over what it means, but it's still, that's the number.
Correct.
I have a question that about something that may have been covered when I had to pop out and go testify down the hall. It's on page 33, figure 4.2, and there was some discussion that I think was aimed at trying to learn what premiums were per member. There was some discussion about how we might be able to calculate some things. And I'm interpreting this chart as showing the top two bars, individual and small group markets, which are the regulated ones, correct?
Correct.
And the large group and associations and trust below are not regulated. And with just looking at this particular chart, the regulated markets, an individual member, be it the covered person, the primary covered person or family member, the average cost in the whole market in the regulated sectors is less than in the others.
And
correct
Mr.
interpretation?
Chair, Representative Harker, yes. The only point I would make, and I think if you read further, we make the point, the benefit structures, my understanding is the benefit structures in these various markets are different. So I don't know that it's fair to just say, well, an individual policy is cheaper than a large group policy. I think the benefits that you're going to see in those policies may vary greatly, which will explain some of that difference. So I don't want to leave a misinterpretation, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. I mean, you're correct. But I think there are some reasons why you may see some price differences. And frankly, in the individual market, one of the major reasons you see the price, I think, that you do there is because you have an underwritten market.
Yes.
So
yes, I thought that might be the case. Good point, excellent point, and I was figuring it probably wasn't as simple as it appeared to be right here.
Well, but it's also not because the large group has families included in that. Per person, per member, I assume, is every member, so a family.
No, I read the text above the chart, and the last paragraph, my interpretation is that this is per covered life. It says member, but that's if it's a family of four.
Certainly not with.
It says 800 divided by the four members.
That's referring to premium costs, I think, not average costs, right? I mean, when you talk about per member per month, don't you talk about all your members, kids, adults, everybody?
Chair Greenlink, members of the committee, that is my understanding, yes.
Yeah, I mean, usually in the insurance, you jump up a member funds, you have 100,000 members, which means some individuals, some two-persons, some families. 100,000 includes that whole amount, and the cost per member per month is calculated in that whole amount. Now, if this is different...
And there is explanation up here that talks about it. I'm actually just reading it really quickly, but average premium per member per month is calculated by dividing the total premiums paid by all members by the total number of members. It's not representative of what a person might pay for an individual health plan. Actual premium rates may differ for individuals and groups based on a number of factors.
So in the large group, there's adults and kids and things in the per member per month calculation, but in the individual, it's only adults.
But we've taken that into account here, Mr. Chair. If you look at, again, the writing above on page 33, average premium per member is only one way to discuss average premiums. In the group market, another common method is average monthly premium for single employee coverage or family coverage. Family coverage will have the highest average since it combines employees and dependents. But then we talk here, for example, consider an employee that spends $400 per month to cover an employee, an additional $400 a month to cover the employee's three dependents. The cost of family coverage is $800. The cost of single coverage is $400, and the cost per member is $200.
Yeah. The cost per member always includes all the members. But, Teresa, in regard, if I could just go off this a second, what Representative Cannon looked at, it would be very useful to look at this large group, this 300 and 308, across the full range of months that those others have. That would get you what you wanted, to see how the increases of that number over the last 6 years compares to the increase in the individual and small group market. I think that would be a good proxy for the...
That might get you what you're looking for.
Get you, well, at least a little indication.
Again, with averages.
Okay. Chair Greenlink, members of the committee, it is important to keep in mind not only is individual insurance medically underwritten, but also the benefits in the individual market are substantially different than the small group market, and then substantially different yet again than the large group market. One of the major distinctions being mandated benefits, such things as mental health parity, do not apply in the individual market. And there are a number of other mandated benefits in Oregon that do not apply to the individual market.
But these things haven't, the nature of the large group hasn't changed over the last 6 years, and the nature, they're different, but what Representative Cannon was looking for is how does the average increase over the last 5 years compare in those segments, and that would probably give you a little bit of a picture of the acceleration of costs in the large group. Now, other things that people drop out, they switch to self-insured plans. I mean, there's a bunch of things happen, but I think I would be interested in seeing how that's changed.
So, okay. Mr. Becker, did you say that the mandates don't apply in the individual market? What am I misunderstanding?
Chair Greenlink, Representative Cannon, many of the mandated benefits do not apply to individual coverage, the most obvious being mental health parity.
Okay, I'm looking at the complete list, and from the insurance division's website, and maybe I can talk to you afterwards, because they're all marked yes as applying to individuals. Chemical dependency says only portability plans, but we can follow up offline.
More?
No, not now. I think I'm saturated.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Becker.
Before you gavel out.
Mr. Chair, I request I move to suspend the rules to permit Representative Nathanson to vote on Senate Bill 1003 and Senate Bill 1047.
There is a motion on the floor. Are there any objections to the motion? Okay. I do that first. Any objection to the motion? The motion carries. The rules are suspended. We'll reopen the work session on
Senate Bill 003, Representative Nathanson, how do you vote?
Aye.
Close the work session on Senate Bill 1003. Open the work session on Senate Bill 1047. Representative Nathanson, how do you vote?
Aye.
Close the work session on Senate Bill 1047. Monday, what do we have on the agenda?
For letting me do that.
With the new work program from several people, and then the review and discussion on dry needling.
A report on how the department is doing with the acquired infection, hospital-acquired infection stuff, and also in that a report from Legacy that's been doing some specific things, and we'll hear from them on how their efforts are going and reducing hospital-acquired infection. And then we'll also have, we'll be hearing from a few folks on the trend, the possible trend in physical therapists involved in what they refer to as dry needle therapy, which sounds to acupuncturists like acupuncture. And we'll be hearing about that on Wednesday. What's the plan?
Is the nature of health insurance.
Like nature of health insurance, right. And then Thursday, if we're still around.
If we're still around, it is an update from upstream mental.
Upstream public health.
Public health, and then prescription drug program update.
A few different things about that. There's been different issues raised about various of the pharmacy things. We'll ask them to talk to us about various things.
And if we're not here Thursday, then when we talk about those things?
In May.
In May. Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
They'll be high on the agenda in the May session.
Thank you.
We are adjourned. Thank you very much.
I got to get those on the calendar.